spells. What is the advantage of a non-verbal spell? Hermione's hands shot into the air. Snape took his time looking around at everybody else, making sure he had no choice, before saying curtly, "Very well, Miss Granger. Your adversary has no warning about what kind of magic you're about to perform," said Hermione, "which gives you a split-second advantage." "An answer copied almost word for word from the Standard Book of Spells, Grade 6," said Snape dismissively. Over in the corner, Malfoy sniggered. "But correct in essentials. Yes, those who progress to using magic without shouting incantations gain an element of surprise in their spellcasting. Not all wizards can do this, of course. It is a question of concentration and mind power, which some," his gaze lingered maliciously upon Harry once more, "lack." Harry knew Snape was thinking of their disastrous occlumency lessons of the previous year. He refused to drop his gaze, but glowered at Snape until Snape looked away. "You will now divide," Snape went on, "into pairs. One partner will attempt to jinx the other without speaking. The other will attempt to repel the jinx in equal silence. Carry on." Although Snape did not know it, Harry had taught at least half the class, everyone who had been a member of the DA, how to perform a shield charm the previous year. None of them had ever cast the charm without speaking, however. A reasonable amount of cheating ensued. Many people were merely whispering the incantation instead of saying it aloud. Typically, 10 minutes into the lesson, Hermione managed to repel Neville's muttered "Jelly Legs Jinx" without uttering a single word, a feat that would surely have earned her 20 points for Gryffindor from any reasonable teacher, thought Harry bitterly, but which Snape ignored. He swept between them as they practiced, looking just as much like an overgrown bat as ever, lingering to watch Harry and Ron struggling with the task. Ron, who was supposed to be jinxing Harry, was purple in the face, his lips tightly compressed to save himself from the temptation of muttering the incantation. Harry had his wand raised, waiting on tenterhooks to repel a jinx that seemed unlikely ever to come. "Pathetic Weasley," said Snape after a while. "Here, let me show you." He turned his wand on Harry so fast that Harry reacted instinctively. All thought of nonverbal spells forgotten, he yelled, "Protego!" His shield charm was so strong, Snape was knocked off balance and hit a desk. The whole class had looked around and now watched as Snape righted himself, scowling. "Do you remember me telling you we are practicing non-verbal spells, Potter?"
"Yes," said Harry stiffly.
"Yes, sir."
"There's no need to call me sir, Professor."
The words had escaped him before he knew what he was saying. Several people gasped, including Hermione. Behind Snape, however, Ron, Dean, and Seamus grinned appreciatively. "Detention! Saturday night, my office," said Snape. "I do not take cheek from anyone, Potter, not even the Chosen One." "That was brilliant, Harry," chortled Ron, once they were safely on their way to break a short while later. "You really shouldn't have said it," said Hermione, frowning at Ron. "What made you?" "He tried to jinx me, in case you didn't notice," fumed Harry. "I had enough of that during those occlumency lessons. Why doesn't he use another guinea pig for a change? What's Dumbledore playing at anyway, letting him teach defense? Did you hear him talking about the dark arts? He loves them. All that unfixed, indestructible stuff."
"Well," said Hermione, "I thought he sounded a bit like you."
"Like me?"
"Yes. When you were telling us what it's like to face Voldemort, you said it wasn't just memorizing a bunch of spells. You said it was just you and your brains and your guts. Well, wasn't that what Snape was saying, that it really comes down to being brave and quick-thinking?"
Harry was so disarmed that she had thought his words as well worth memorizing as the Standard Book of Spells that he did not argue. "Harry! Hey, Harry!" Harry looked around.
Jack Sloper, one of the beaters on last year's Gryffindor Quidditch team, was hurrying toward him holding a roll of parchment.
"For you?" panted Sloper. "Listen, I heard you're the new captain. When are you holding trials?"
"I'm not sure yet," said Harry, thinking privately that Sloper would be very lucky to get back on the team.
"I'll let you know." "Oh, right. I was hoping it'd be this weekend."
But Harry was not listening. He had just recognized the thin, slanting writing on the parchment. Leaving Sloper in mid-sentence, he hurried away with Ron and Hermione, unrolling the parchment as he went.
"Dear Harry, I would like to start our private lessons this Saturday. Kindly come along to my office at 8 p.m. I hope you are enjoying your first day back at school. Yours sincerely, Albus Dumbledore. P.S. I enjoy acid pops."
"He enjoys acid pops?"
said Ron, who had read the message over Harry's shoulder and was looking perplexed. "It's the password to get past the gargoyle outside his study," said Harry in a low voice.
"Ha! Snape's not going to be pleased. I won't be able to do his detention."
He, Ron and Hermione spent the whole of break speculating on what Dumbledore would teach Harry. Ron thought it most likely to be spectacular jinxes and hexes of the type the Death Eaters would not know. Hermione said such things were illegal, and thought it much more likely that Dumbledore wanted to teach Harry advanced defensive magic. After break, she went off to Arithmancy while Harry and Ron returned to the common room, where they grudgingly started Snape's homework. This turned out to be so complex that they still had not finished when Hermione joined them for their after-lunch free period, though she considerably speeded up the process. They had only just finished when the bell rang for the afternoon's double potions, and they beat the familiar path down to the dungeon classroom that had, for so long, been Snape's. When they arrived in the corridor, they saw that there were only a dozen people progressing to NEWT level. Crabbe and Goyle had evidently failed to achieve the required OWL grade, but four Slytherins had made it through, including Malfoy. Four Ravenclaws were there, and one Hufflepuff, Ernie McMillan, whom Harry liked, despite his rather pompous manner.
"Harry," Ernie said portentously, holding out his hand as Harry approached. "Didn't get a chance to speak in defense against the Dark Arts this morning. Good lesson, I thought. But shield charms are old hat, of course, for us old D.A. lags. And how are you, Ron, Hermione?"
Before they could say more than, "Fine," the dungeon door opened and Slughorn's belly preceded him out of the door. As they filed into the room, his great walrus moustache curved above his beaming mouth, and he greeted Harry and Zabini with particular enthusiasm. The dungeon was, most unusually, already full of vapours and odd smells. Harry, Ron and Hermione sniffed interestedly as they passed large, bubbling cauldrons. The four Slytherins took a table together, as did the four Ravenclaws. This left Harry, Ron and Hermione to share a table with Ernie. They chose the one nearest a gold-coloured cauldron that was emitting one of the most seductive scents Harry had ever inhaled. Somehow, it reminded him simultaneously of treacle tart, the woody smell of a broomstick handle, and something flowery he thought he might have smelled at the Burrow. He found that he was breathing very slowly and deeply, and that the potion's fumes seemed to be filling him up like drink. A great contentment stole over him. He grinned across at Ron, who grinned back lazily.
Now then, said Slughorn, whose massive outline was quivering through the many shimmering vapours. Scales out, everyone, and potion kits, and don't forget your copies of Advanced Potion Making.
Sir, said Harry, raising his hand.
Harry, my boy?
I haven't got a book or scales or anything, nor has Ron. We didn't realize we'd be able to do the NEWT, you see.
Ah, yes, Professor McGonagall did mention. Not to worry, my dear boy, not to worry at all. You can use ingredients from the store cupboard today, and I'm sure we can lend you some scales. And we've got a small stock of old books here. They'll do until you can write to Flourish and Blotts.
Slughorn strode over to a corner cupboard, and after a moment's foraging, emerged with two very battered-looking copies of Advanced Potion-Making by Libatius Borage, which he gave to Harry and Ron, along with two sets of tarnished scales.
"Now then," said Slughorn, returning to the front of the class and inflating his already bulging chest so that the buttons on his waistcoat threatened to burst off. "I've prepared a few potions for you to have a look at, just out of interest, you know. These are the kind of thing you ought to be able to make after completing your NEWTs. You ought to have heard of them, even if you haven't made them yet. Anyone tell me what this one is?"
He indicated the cauldron nearest the Slytherin table. Harry raised himself slightly in his seat and saw what looked like plain water boiling away inside it. Hermione's well-practiced hand hit the air before anybody else's. Slughorn pointed at her.
"It's Veritaserum, a colourless, odourless potion that forces the drinker to tell the truth," said Hermione. "Very good, very good," said Slughorn happily. "Now," he continued, pointing at the cauldron nearest the Ravenclaw table, "this one here is pretty well known, featured in a few ministry leaflets lately, too. Who can—"
Hermione's hand was fastest once more.
"It's Polyjuice Potion, sir," she said.
Harry, too, had recognized the slow, bubbling, mud-like substance in the second cauldron, but did not resent Hermione getting the credit for answering the question. She, after all, was the one who had succeeded in making it back in their second year.
"Excellent, excellent. Now, this one here..." "Yes, my dear,"
said Slughorn, now looking slightly bemused as Hermione's hand punched the air again.
"It's Amortentia." "It is indeed. It seems almost foolish to ask," said Slughorn, who was looking mightily impressed. "But I assume you know what it does?" "It's the most powerful love potion in the world," said Hermione. "Quite right. You recognized it, I suppose, by its distinctive mother-of-pearl sheen."
"And the steam rising in characteristic spirals," said Hermione enthusiastically. "And it's supposed to smell differently to each of us, according to what attracts us. And I can smell freshly mown grass, and new parchment, and—"
But she turned slightly pink and did not complete the sentence.
"May I ask your name, my dear?" said Slughorn, ignoring Hermione's embarrassment. "Hermione Granger, sir." "Granger. Granger. Can you possibly be related to Hector Dagworth Granger, who founded the most extraordinary society of potioneers?"
"No, I don't think so, sir. I'm Muggle-born, you see."
Harry saw Malfoy lean close to Nott and whisper something. Both of them sniggered, but Slughorn showed no dismay. On the contrary, he beamed and looked from Hermione to Harry, who was sitting next to her.
"Oh, ho, ho! One of my best friends is Muggle-born, and she's the best in our year. I'm assuming this is the very friend of whom you spoke, Harry."
"Yes, sir," said Harry.
"Well, well, take 20 well-earned points for Gryffindor, Miss Granger," said Slughorn genially.
Malfoy looked rather as he had done the time Hermione had punched him in the face. Hermione turned to Harry with a radiant face and whispered,
"Did you really tell him I'm the best in the year? Oh, Harry."
"Well, what's so impressive about that?"
whispered Ron, who for some reason looked annoyed.
"You are the best in the gear. I'd have told him so if he'd asked me."
Hermione smiled but made a shing gesture so that they could hear what Slughorn was saying. Ron looked slightly disgruntled.
"Amortentia doesn't really create love, of course. It is impossible to manufacture or imitate love. No, this will simply cause a powerful infatuation or obsession. It is probably the most dangerous and powerful potion in this room." "Oh, yes,"
he said, nodding gravely at Malfoy and Nott, both of whom were smirking skeptically.
When you have seen as much of life as I have, you will not underestimate the power of obsessive love. And now, said Slughorn, it is time for us to start work.
Sir, you haven't told us what's in this one, said Ernie Macmillan, pointing at a small black cauldron standing on Slughorn's desk.
The potion within was splashing about merrily. It was the color of molten gold, and large drops were leaping like goldfish above the surface, though not a particle had spilled.
Oh-ho! Said Slughorn again.
Harry was sure that Slughorn had not forgotten the potion at all, but had waited to be asked for dramatic effect.
Yes, that! Well, that one, ladies and gentlemen, is a most curious little potion called Felix Felicis. I take it,
he turned, smiling, to look at Hermione, who had let out an audible gasp,
that you know what Felix Felicis does, Miss Granger. It's liquid luck, said Hermione excitedly. It makes you lucky.
The whole class seemed to sit up a little straighter. Now all Harry could see of Malfoy was the back of his sleek blonde head, because he was at last giving Slughorn his full and undivided attention.
Quite right. Take another 10 points for Gryffindor. Yes, it's a funny little potion, Felix Felicis, said Slughorn. Desperately tricky to make and disastrous to get wrong. However, if brewed correctly, as this has been, you will find that all your endeavors tend to succeed, at least until the effects wear off. Why don't people drink it all the time, sir? Said Terry Boot eagerly. Because if taken in excess, it causes giddiness, recklessness, and dangerous overconfidence, said Slughorn. Too much of a good thing, you know. Highly toxic in large quantities, but taken sparingly and very occasionally.
Have you ever taken it, sir?
Asked Michael Corner with great interest.
Twice in my life, said Slughorn. Once when I was 24, once when I was 57. 2 tablespoonfuls taken with breakfast, 2 perfect days.
He gazed dreamily into the distance. Whether he was play-acting or not, thought Harry, the effect was good.
And that, said Slughorn, apparently coming back to earth, is what I shall be offering as a prize in this lesson.
There was silence, in which every bubble and gurgle of the surrounding potions seemed magnified tenfold.
1 tiny bottle of Felix Felicis, said Slughorn, taking a minuscule glass bottle with a cork in it out of his pocket and showing it to them all. Enough for 12 hours' luck. From dawn till dusk, you will be lucky in everything you attempt. Now, I must give you warning that Felix Felicis is a banned substance in organized competitions, sporting events, for instance, examinations or elections. So the winner is to use it on an ordinary day only, and watch how that ordinary day becomes extraordinary. So, said Slughorn, suddenly brisk, how are you to win my fabulous prize? Well, by turning to page 10 of Advanced Potion Making. We have a little over an hour left to us, which should be time for you to make a decent attempt at the draft of living death. I know it is more complex than anything you have attempted before, and I do not expect a perfect potion from anybody. The person who does best, however, will win little Felix here. Off you go!
There was a scraping as everyone drew their cauldrons toward them, and some loud clunks as people began adding weights to their scales. But nobody spoke. The concentration within the room was almost tangible. Harry saw Malfoy riffling feverishly through his copy of Advanced Potion Making. It could not have been clearer that Malfoy really wanted that lucky day. Harry bent swiftly over the tattered book Slughorn had lent him. To his annoyance, he saw that the previous owner had scribbled all over the pages so that the margins were as black as the printed portions. Bending low to decipher the ingredients, Even here the previous owner had made annotations and crossed things out. Harry hurried off toward the store cupboard to find what he needed. As he dashed back to his cauldron, he saw Malfoy cutting up valerian roots as fast as he could. Everyone kept glancing around at what the rest of the class was doing. This was both an advantage and a disadvantage of potions, that it was hard to keep your work private. Within 10 minutes, the whole place was full of bluish steam. Hermione, of course, seemed to have progressed furthest. Her potion already resembled the smooth, blackcurrant-coloured liquid mentioned as the ideal halfway stage. Having finished chopping his roots, Harry bent low over his book again. It was really very irritating having to try and decipher the directions under all the stupid scribbles of the previous owner, who for some reason had taken issue with the order to cut up the sapophorus bean and had written in the alternative instruction, "Crush with flat side of silver dagger, releases juice better than cutting."
"Sir, I think you knew my grandfather, Abraxas Malfoy."
Harry looked up. Slughorn was just passing the Slytherin table.
"Yes," said Slughorn, without looking at Malfoy. "I was sorry to hear he had died, although, of course, it wasn't unexpected. Dragon pox at his age."
And he walked away. Harry bent back over his cauldron, smirking. He could tell that Malfoy had expected to be treated like Harry or Sabini, perhaps even hoped for some preferential treatment of the type he had learned to expect from Snape. It looked as though Malfoy would have to rely on nothing but talent to win the bottle of Felix Felicis. The sapophorus bean was proving very difficult to cut up. Harry turned to Hermione.
"Can I borrow your silver knife?"
She nodded impatiently, not taking her eyes off her potion, which was still deep purple, though, according to the book, ought to be turning a light shade of lilac by now. Harry crushed his bean with the flat side of the dagger. To his astonishment, it immediately exuded so much juice, he was amazed the shriveled bean could have held it all. Hastily scooping it all into the cauldron, he saw, to his surprise, that the potion immediately turned exactly the shade of lilac described by the textbook. His annoyance with the previous owner vanishing on the spot, Harry now squinted at the next line of instructions. According to the book, he had to stir counterclockwise until the potion turned clear as water. According to the addition the previous owner had made, however, he ought to add a clockwise stir after every 7th counterclockwise stir. Could the old owner be right twice? Harry stirred counterclockwise, held his breath, and stirred once clockwise. The effect was immediate. The potion turned palest pink.
"How are you doing that?"
demanded Hermione, who was red-faced and whose hair was growing bushier and bushier in the fumes from her cauldron. Her potion was still resolutely purple.
"Add a clockwise stir."
"No,
no, the book says counterclockwise," she snapped.
Harry shrugged and continued what he was doing. 7 stirs counterclockwise, 1 clockwise. Pause. 7 stirs counterclockwise, 1 stir clockwise. Across the table, Ron was cursing fluently under his breath. His potion looked like liquid licorice. Harry glanced around. As far as he could see, no one else's potion had turned as pale as his. He felt elated, something that had certainly never happened before in this dungeon.
"And time's up," called Slughorn. "Stop stirring, please."
Slughorn moved slowly among the tables, peering into cauldrons. He made no comment, but occasionally gave the potions a stir or a sniff. At last he reached the table where Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Ernie were sitting. He smiled ruefully at the tar-like substance in Ron's cauldron. He passed over Ernie's navy concoction. Hermione's potion he gave an approving nod. Then he saw Harry's, and a look of incredulous delight spread over his face.
"The clear winner!" he cried to the dungeon. "Excellent, excellent, Harry! Good Lord! It's clear you've inherited your mother's talent. She was a dab hand at potions, Lily was. Here you are, then, here you are. 1 bottle of Felix Felicis, as promised, and use it well."
Harry slipped the tiny bottle of golden liquid into his inner pocket, feeling an odd combination of delight at the furious looks on the Slytherins' faces and guilt at the disappointed expression on Hermione's. Ron looked simply dumbfounded.
"How did you do that?"
he whispered to Harry as they left the dungeon. "Got lucky, I suppose," said Harry, because Malfoy was within earshot. Once they were securely ensconced at the Gryffindor table for dinner, however, he felt safe enough to tell them. Hermione's face became stonier with every word he uttered. "I suppose you think I cheated," he finished, aggravated by her expression.
"Well, it wasn't exactly your own work, was it?"
she said stiffly.
"He only followed different instructions to ours," said Ron. "Could have been a catastrophe, couldn't it? But he took a risk, and it paid off."
He heaved a sigh. "Slughorn could have handed me that book, but no, I get the one no one's ever written on. Puked on, by the look of page 52, but..."
"Hang on,"
said a voice close by Harry's left ear, and he caught a sudden waft of that flowery smell he had picked up in Slughorn's dungeon. He looked around and saw that Ginny had joined them.
"Did I hear right? You've been taking orders from something someone wrote in a book, Harry?"
She looked alarmed and angry. Harry knew what was on her mind at once.
"It's nothing," he said reassuringly, lowering his voice. "It's not like, you know, Riddle's diary. It's just an old textbook someone scribbled on." "But you're doing what it says." "I just tried a few of the tips written in the margins. Honestly, Ginny, there's nothing funny." "Ginny's got a point," said Hermione, perking up at once. "We ought to check out that there's nothing odd about it. I mean, all these funny instructions. Who knows?"
"Hey," said Harry indignantly as she pulled his copy of Advanced Potion Making out of his bag and raised her wand.
"Specialis Revelio,"
she said, wrapping it smartly on the front cover. Nothing whatsoever happened. The book simply lay there, looking old and dirty and dog-eared.
"Finished?"
said Harry irritably. "Or do you want to wait and see if it does a few backflips?"
"It seems all right,"
said Hermione, still staring at the book suspiciously.
"I mean, it really does seem to be just a textbook."
"Good, then I'll have it back," said Harry, snatching it off the table, but it slipped from his hand and landed open on the floor. Nobody else was looking. Harry bent low to retrieve the book, and, as he did so, he saw something scribbled along the bottom of the back cover, in the same small, cramped handwriting as the instructions that had won him his bottle of Felix Felicis, now safely hidden inside a pair of socks in his trunk upstairs. "This book is the property of the Half-Blood Prince." Chapter 10. The House of Gaunt. For the rest of the week's potions lessons, Harry continued to follow the Half-Blood Prince's instructions wherever they deviated from libaceous Borage's, with the result that by their fourth lesson, Slughorn was raving about Harry's abilities, saying that he had rarely taught anyone so talented. Neither Ron nor Hermione was delighted by this. Although Harry had offered to share his book with both of them, Ron had more difficulty deciphering the handwriting than Harry did, and could not keep asking Harry to read aloud, or it might look suspicious. Hermione, meanwhile, was resolutely ploughing on with what she called the official instructions, but becoming increasingly bad-tempered as they yielded poorer results than the prince's. Harry wondered vaguely who the Half-Blood Prince had been. Although the amount of homework they had been given prevented him from reading the whole of his copy of Advanced Potion Making, he had skimmed through it sufficiently to see that there was barely a page on which the prince had not made additional notes, not all of them concerned with potion making. Here and there were directions for what looked like spells that the prince had made up himself.
"Or herself,"
said Hermione irritably, overhearing Harry pointing some of these out to Ron in the common room on Saturday evening.
"It might have been a girl. I think the handwriting looks more like a girl's than a boy's."
"The Half-Blood Prince, he was called," Harry said. "How many girls have been princes?"
Hermione seemed to have no answer to this. She merely scowled and twitched her essay on The Principles of Rematerialization away from Ron, who was trying to read it upside down. Harry looked at his watch and hurriedly put the old copy of Advanced Potion Making back into his bag.
It's 7:55. I'd better go. I'll be late for Dumbledore.
Oh,
gasped Hermione, looking up at once.
Good luck. We'll wait up. We want to hear what he teaches you.
Hope it goes okay, said Ron, and the pair of them watched Harry leave through the portrait hole. Harry proceeded through deserted corridors, though he had to step hastily behind a statue when Professor Trelawney appeared around a corner, muttering to herself as she shuffled a pack of dirty-looking playing cards, reading them as she walked.
Two of spades, conflict,
she murmured as she passed the place where Harry crouched, hidden.
Seven of spades, an ill omen. Ten of spades, violence. Knave of spades, a dark young man, possibly troubled, one who dislikes the questioner?
She stopped dead, right on the other side of Harry's statue.
Well, that can't be right,
she said, annoyed, and Harry heard her reshuffling vigorously as she set off again, leaving nothing but a whiff of cooking sherry behind her. Harry waited until he was quite sure she had gone, then hurried off again until he reached the spot in the 7th-floor corridor where a single gargoyle stood against the wall.
Acid pops, said Harry,
and the gargoyle leapt aside. The wall behind it slid apart, and a moving spiral stone staircase was revealed, onto which Harry stepped, so that he was carried in smooth circles up to the door with a brass knocker that led to Dumbledore's office. Harry knocked.
Come in, said Dumbledore's voice.
Good evening, sir, said Harry, walking into the headmaster's office.
Ah, good evening, Harry. Sit down,
said Dumbledore, smiling.
I hope you've had an enjoyable first week back at school.
Yes, thanks, sir, said Harry.
You must have been busy. A detention under your belt already?
Began Harry awkwardly, but Dumbledore did not look too stern.
I have arranged with Professor Snape that you will do your detention next Saturday instead.
Right, said Harry, who had more pressing matters on his mind than Snape's detention, and now looked around surreptitiously for some indication of what Dumbledore was planning to do with him this evening. The circular office looked just as it always did. The delicate silver instruments stood on spindle-legged tables, puffing smoke and whirring. Portraits of previous headmasters and headmistresses dozed in their frames, and Dumbledore's magnificent phoenix, Fawkes, stood on his perch behind the door, watching Harry with bright interest. It did not even look as though Dumbledore had cleared a space for dueling practice.
So, Harry, said Dumbledore in a business-like voice, you have been wondering, I am sure, what I have planned for you during these, for want of a better word, lessons.
Yes, sir.
Well, I have decided that it is time, now that you know what prompted Lord Voldemort to try and kill you 15 years ago, for you to be given certain information.
There was a pause. You said at the end of last term you were going to tell me everything, said Harry. It was hard to keep a note of accusation from his voice.
Sir, he added. And so I did, said Dumbledore placidly. I told you everything I know. From this point forth, we shall be leaving the firm foundation of fact and journeying together through the murky marshes of memory into thickets of wildest guesswork. From here on in, Harry, I may be as woefully wrong as Humphrey Belcher, who believed the time was ripe for a cheese cauldron.
But you think you're right, said Harry.
Naturally I do. But as I have already proven to you, I make mistakes like the next man. In fact, being, forgive me, rather cleverer than most men, my mistakes tend to be correspondingly huger.
Sir, said Harry tentatively, does what you're going to tell me have anything to do with the prophecy? Will it help me survive?
It has a very great deal to do with the prophecy,
said Dumbledore, as casually as if Harry had asked him about the next day's weather.
And I certainly hope that it will help you to survive.
Dumbledore got to his feet and walked around the desk past Harry, who turned eagerly in his seat to watch Dumbledore bending over the cabinet beside the door. When Dumbledore straightened up, he was holding a familiar shallow stone basin etched with odd markings around its rim. He placed the pensive on the desk in front of Harry.
You look worried.
Harry had indeed been eyeing the pensive with some apprehension. His previous experiences with the odd device that stored and revealed thoughts and memories, though highly instructive, had also been uncomfortable. The last time he had disturbed its contents, he had seen much more than he would have wished. But Dumbledore was smiling.
"This time you enter the pensive with me, and even more unusually, with permission."
"Where are we going, sir?"
"For a trip down Bob Ogden's memory lane," said Dumbledore, pulling from his pocket a crystal bottle containing a swirling silvery-white substance.
"Who was Bob Ogden?"
"He was employed by the Department of Magical Law Enforcement," said Dumbledore. "He died some time ago, but not before I tracked him down and persuaded him to confide these recollections to me. We are about to accompany him on a visit he made in the course of his duties. If you will stand, Harry..."
But Dumbledore was having difficulty pulling out the stopper of the crystal bottle. His injured hand seemed stiff and painful.
Shall I, sir?" "No matter, Harry."
Dumbledore pointed his wand at the bottle, and the cork flew out.
"Sir,
how did you injure your hand?" Harry asked again, looking at the blackened fingers with a mixture of revulsion and pity.
"Now is not the moment for that story, Harry. Not yet. We have an appointment with Bob Ogden."
Dumbledore tipped the silvery contents of the bottle into the pensive, where they swirled and shimmered, neither liquid nor gas.
"After you," said Dumbledore, gesturing toward the bowl.
Harry bent forward, took a deep breath, and plunged his face into the silvery substance. He felt his feet leave the office floor. He was falling, falling through whirling darkness, and then, quite suddenly, he was blinking in dazzling sunlight. Before his eyes had adjusted, Dumbledore landed beside him. They were standing in a country lane bordered by high, tangled hedgerows, beneath a summer sky as bright and blue as a forget-me-not. Some 10 feet in front of them stood a short, plump man, wearing enormously thick glasses that reduced his eyes to mole-like specks. He was reading a wooden signpost that was sticking out of the brambles on the left-hand side of the road. Harry knew this must be Ogden. He was the only person in sight, and he was also wearing the strange assortment of clothes so often chosen by inexperienced wizards trying to look like muggles. In this case, a frock coat and spats over a striped one-piece bathing costume. Before Harry had time to do more than register his bizarre appearance, however, Ogden had set off at a brisk walk down the lane. Dumbledore and Harry followed. As they passed the wooden sign, Harry looked up at its two arms. The one pointing back the way they had come read, "Great Hangleton, 5 miles." The arm pointing after Ogden said, "Little Hangleton, 1 mile." They walked a short way with nothing to see but the hedgerows, the wide blue sky overhead, and the swishing, frock-coated figure ahead. Then the lane curved to the left and fell away, sloping steeply down a hillside, so that they had a sudden, unexpected view of a whole valley laid out in front of them. Harry could see a village, undoubtedly Little Hangleton, nestled between 2 steep hills, its church and graveyard clearly visible. Across the valley, set on the opposite hillside, was a handsome manor house surrounded by a wide expanse of velvety green lawn. Ogden had broken into a reluctant trot due to the steep downward slope. Dumbledore lengthened his stride, and Harry hurried to keep up. He thought Little Hangleton must be their final destination, and wondered, as he had done on the night they had found Slughorn, why they had to approach it from such a distance. He soon discovered that he was mistaken in thinking that they were going to the village, however. The lane curved to the right, and when they rounded the corner, it was to see the very edge of Ogden's frock coat vanishing through a gap in the hedge. Dumbledore and Harry followed him onto a narrow dirt track bordered by higher and wilder hedgerows than those they had left behind. The path was crooked, rocky, and potholed, sloping downhill like the last one, and it seemed to be heading for a patch of dark trees a little below them. Sure enough, the track soon opened up at the copse, and Dumbledore and Harry came to a halt behind Ogden, who had stopped and drawn his wand. Despite the cloudless sky, the old trees ahead cast deep, dark, cool shadows, and it was a few seconds before Harry's eyes discerned the building, half hidden amongst the tangle of trunks. It seemed to him a very strange location to choose for a house, or else an odd decision to leave the trees growing nearby, blocking all light and the view of the valley below. He wondered whether it was inhabited. Its walls were mossy, and so many tiles had fallen off the roof that the rafters were visible in places. Nettles grew all around it, their tips reaching the windows, which were tiny and thick with grime. Just as he had concluded that nobody could possibly live there, however, one of the windows was thrown open with a clatter, and a thin trickle of steam or smoke issued from it, as though somebody was cooking. Ogden moved forward quietly, and, it seemed to Harry, rather cautiously. As the dark shadows of the trees slid over him, he stopped again, staring at the front door, to which somebody had nailed a dead snake. Then there was a rustle and a crack, and a man in rags dropped from the nearest tree, landing on his feet right in front of Ogden, who leapt backwards so fast he stood on the tails of his frock coat and stumbled.
"You're not welcome."
The man standing before them had thick hair, so matted with dirt it could have been any color. Several of his teeth were missing. His eyes were small and dark and stared in opposite directions. He might have looked comical, but he did not. The effect was frightening, and Harry could not blame Ogden for backing away several more paces before he spoke.
Good morning. I'm from the Ministry of Magic.
You're not welcome.
I'm sorry. I don't understand you, said Ogden nervously.
Harry thought Ogden was being extremely dim. The stranger was making himself very clear in Harry's opinion, particularly as he was brandishing a wand in one hand and a short and rather bloody knife in the other.
"You understand him, I'm sure, Harry," said Dumbledore quietly. "Yes, of course," said Harry, slightly nonplussed. "Why can't Ogden?"
But as his eyes found the dead snake on the door again, he suddenly understood.
"He's speaking Parseltongue?" "Very good," said Dumbledore, nodding and smiling.
The man in rags was now advancing on Ogden, knife in one hand, wand in the other.
"Now, look,"
Ogden began, but too late. There was a bang, and Ogden was on the ground, clutching his nose, while a nasty yellowish goo squirted from between his fingers.
"Morphin!" said a loud voice.
An elderly man had come hurrying out of the cottage, banging the door behind him so that the dead snake swung pathetically. This man was shorter than the first and oddly proportioned. His shoulders were very broad and his arms overlong, which, with his bright brown eyes, short scrubby hair, and wrinkled face, gave him the look of a powerful, aged monkey. He came to a halt beside the man with the knife, who was now cackling with laughter at the sight of Ogden on the ground.
"Ministry, is it?" said the older man, looking down at Ogden.
"Correct,"
said Ogden angrily, dabbing his face.
"And you, I take it, are Mr. Gaunt."
"That's right," said Gaunt. "Got you in the face, did he?"
"Yes, he did,"
snapped Ogden.
"Should have made your presence known, shouldn't you?"
said Gaunt aggressively.
"This is private property. Can't just walk in here and not expect my son to defend himself."
"Defend himself against what, man?"
said Ogden, clambering back to his feet.
"Busybodies, intruders, muggles and filth."
Ogden pointed his wand at his own nose, which was still issuing large amounts of what looked like yellow pus, and the flow stopped at once. Mr. Gaunt spoke out of the corner of his mouth to Morphin.
"Get in the house. Don't argue."
This time, ready for it, Harry recognized Parseltongue. Even while he could understand what was being said, he distinguished the weird hissing noise that was all Ogden could hear. Morphin seemed to be on the point of disagreeing, but when his father cast him a threatening look, he changed his mind, lumbering away to the cottage with an odd rolling gait and slamming the front door behind him so that the snake swung sadly again.
"It's your son I'm here to see, Mr. Gaunt,"
said Ogden as he mopped the last of the pus from the front of his coat.
"That was Morphin, wasn't it?"
"Ah, that was Morphin," said the old man indifferently. "Are you pure blood?"
he asked, suddenly aggressive.
"That's neither here nor there,"
said Ogden coldly, and Harry felt his respect for Ogden rise. Apparently Gaunt felt rather differently. He squinted into Ogden's face and muttered, in what was clearly supposed to be an offensive tone,
Now I come to think about it, I've seen noses like yours down in the village.
I don't doubt it, if your son's been let loose on them, said Ogden. Perhaps we could continue this discussion inside.
Inside?
Yes, Mr. Gaunt. I've already told you I'm here about Morfin. We sent an owl.
I've no use for owls, said Gaunt. I don't open letters.
Then you can hardly complain that you get no warning of visitors, said Ogden tartly. I am here following a serious breach of wizarding law, which occurred here in the early hours of this morning.
All right, all right, all right, bellowed Gorn. Come in the bleeding house, then, and much good it'll do here.
The house seemed to contain three tiny rooms. Two doors led off the main room, which served as kitchen and living room combined. Morfin was sitting in a filthy armchair beside the smoking fire, twisting a live adder between his thick fingers and crooning softly at it in parcel tongue.
Hissy, hissy, little snakey, slither on the floor. You be good to Morfin, or he'll nail you to the door.
There was a scuffling noise in the corner beside the open window, and Harry realized that there was somebody else in the room, a girl whose ragged grey dress was the exact colour of the dirty stone wall behind her. She was standing beside a steaming pot on a grimy black stove and was fiddling around with a shelf of squalid-looking pots and pans above it. Her hair was lank and dull, and she had a plain, pale, rather heavy face. Her eyes, like her brother's, stared in opposite directions. She looked a little cleaner than the two men, but Harry thought he had never seen a more defeated-looking person.
"My daughter, Merope," said Gaunt grudgingly,
as Ogden looked inquiringly toward her.
"Good morning," said Ogden.
She did not answer, but with a frightened glance at her father, turned her back on the room and continued shifting the pots on the shelf behind her.
"Well, Mr. Gaunt," said Ogden,
"to get straight to the point, we have reason to believe that your son, Morfin, performed magic in front of a muggle late last night."
There was a deafening clang. Merope had dropped one of the pots.
"Pick it up," Gaunt bellowed at her. "That's it. Grab on the floor like some filthy muggle. What's your one for, you useless sack of muck?"
"Mr. Gaunt, please,"
said Ogden in a shocked voice, as Merope, who had already picked up the pot, flushed blotchily scarlet, lost her grip on the pot again, drew her wand shakily from her pocket, pointed it at the pot, and muttered a hasty, inaudible spell that caused the pot to shoot across the floor away from her, hit the opposite wall, and crack in two. Morfin let out a mad cackle of laughter. Gaunt screamed,
"Mend it, you pointless lump, mend it!"
Merope stumbled across the room, but before she had time to raise her wand, Ogden had lifted his own and said firmly,
"Reparo!"
The pot mended itself instantly. Gaunt looked for a moment as though he was going to shout at Ogden, but seemed to think better of it. Instead, he jeered at his daughter.
"Lucky the nice man from the ministry's here, isn't it? Perhaps he'll take you off my hands. Perhaps he doesn't mind dirty squibs."
Without looking at anybody or thanking Ogden, Merope picked up the pot and returned it, hands trembling, to its shelf. She then stood quite still, her back against the wall, between the filthy window and the stove, as though she wished for nothing more than to sink into the stone and vanish.
"Mr. Gaunt,"
Ogden began again,
"as I've said, the reason for my visit..."
"I heard you the first time," snapped Gaunt. "So what? Morfin gave a muggle a bit of what was coming to him. What about it, then?"
"Morfin has broken wizarding law," said Ogden sternly.
"Morfin has broken wizarding law,"
Gaunt imitated Ogden's voice, making it pompous and sing-song. Morfin cackled again.
"He taught a filthy muggle a lesson. That's illegal now, is it?"
"Yes," said Ogden. "I'm afraid it is."
He pulled from an inside pocket a small scroll of parchment and unrolled it.
"What's that, then? His sentence?"
said Gaunt, his voice rising angrily.
"It is a summons to the ministry for a hearing."
"Summons? Summons? Who do you think you are, summoning my son anywhere?"
"I'm head of the magical law enforcement squad," said Ogden.
And you think we're scum, do you?
Screamed Gaunt, advancing on Ogden now with a dirty yellow-nailed finger pointing at his chest.
Scum? Who'll come running when the Ministry tells them to? You know who you're talking to, you filthy little mudblood, do you?
I was under the impression that I was speaking to Mr. Gaunt,
said Ogden, looking wary, but standing his ground.
That's right, roared Gaunt.
For a moment, Harry thought Gaunt was making an obscene hand gesture, but then realized that he was showing Ogden the ugly black stone ring he was wearing on his middle finger, waving it before Ogden's eyes.
See this? See this? Know what it is? Know where it came from? Centuries it's been in our family. That's how far back we go, and pure blood all the way. Know how much I've been offered for this? With a Peverell coat of arms engraved on a stone?
I've really no idea,
said Ogden, blinking as the ring sailed within an inch of his nose.
And it's quite beside the point, Mr. Gaunt. Your son has committed.
With a howl of rage, Gaunt ran toward his daughter. For a split second, Harry thought he was going to throttle her as his hand flew to her throat. Next moment, he was dragging her toward Ogden by a gold chain around her neck.
See this?
He bellowed at Ogden, shaking a heavy gold locket at him, while Merope spluttered and gasped for breath.
I see it, I see it, said Ogden hastily.
Slytherins,
yelled Gaunt.
Salazar Slytherins, we're his last living descendants. What do you say to that, eh?
Mr. Gaunt, your daughter,
said Ogden in alarm, but Gaunt had already released Merope. She staggered away from him, back to her corner, massaging her neck and gulping for air.
So,
said Gaunt triumphantly, as though he had just proved a complicated point beyond all possible dispute.
Don't you go talking to us as if we're dirt on your shoes. Generations of pure bloods, wizards all. More than you can say, I don't doubt.
And he spat on the floor at Ogden's feet. Morfin cackled again. Merope, huddled beside the window, her head bowed and her face hidden by her lank hair, said nothing.
Mr. Gaunt,
said Ogden doggedly.
I am afraid that neither your ancestors nor mine have anything to do with the matter in hand. I am here because of Morfin. Morfin and the muggle he accosted late last night. Our information,
he glanced down at his scroll of parchment,
is that Morfin performed a jinx or hex on the said muggle, causing him to erupt in highly painful hives.
Morfin giggled.
Be quiet, boy,
snarled Gaunt in parcel tongue, and Morfin fell silent again.
And so what if he did then?
Gaunt said defiantly to Ogden.
I expect you've wiped the muggle's filthy face clean for him, and his memory to boot.
That's hardly the point, is it, Mr. Gaunt?
Said Ogden.
This was an unprovoked attack on a defenseless...
I had you marked out as a muggle lover the moment I saw you.
Sneered Gaunt, and he spat on the floor again.
This discussion is getting us nowhere,
said Ogden firmly.
It is clear from your son's attitude that he feels no remorse for his actions.
He glanced down at his scroll of parchment again.
Morfin will attend a hearing on the 14th of September to answer the charges of using magic in front of a muggle and causing harm and distress to that same mug.
Ogden broke off. The jingling, clopping sounds of horses and loud laughing voices were drifting in through the open window. Apparently the winding lane to the village passed very close to the copse where the house stood. Gaunt froze, listening, his eyes wide. Morfin hissed and turned his face toward the sounds, his expression hungry. Merope raised her head. Her face, Harry saw, was starkly white.
My God, what an eyesore!
Rang out a girl's voice, as clearly audible through the open window as if she had stood in the room beside them.
Couldn't your father have that hovel cleared away, Tom?
It's not ours, said a young man's voice. Everything on the other side of the valley belongs to us, but that cottage belongs to an old tramp called Gaunt and his children. The son's quite mad. You should hear some of the stories they tell in the village.
The girl laughed. The jingling, clopping noises were growing louder and louder. Morfin made to get out of his armchair.
Keep your seat,
said his father warningly, in parcel tongue.
Tom,
said the girl's voice again, now so close they were clearly right beside the house.
I might be wrong, but has somebody nailed a snake to that door?
Good Lord, you're right,
said the man's voice.
That'll be the sun. I told you he's not right in the head. Don't look at it, Cecilia, darling.
The jingling and clopping sounds were now growing fainter again.
Darling,
whispered Morfin in Parseltongue, looking at his sister.
Darling, he called her, so he wouldn't have you anyway.
Merope was so white, Harry felt sure she was going to faint.
What's that?
Said Gaunt sharply, also in Parseltongue, looking from his son to his daughter.
What did you say, Morfin? She likes looking at that muggle,
said Morfin, a vicious expression on his face as he stared at his sister, who now looked terrified.
Always in the garden when he passes, peering through the hedge at him, isn't she? And last night...
Merope shook her head jerkily, imploringly, but Morfin went on ruthlessly.
Hanging out of the window, waiting for him to ride home, wasn't she? Hanging out of the window to look at a muggle, said Gaunt quietly.
All three of the Gaunts seemed to have forgotten Ogden, who was looking both bewildered and irritated at this renewed outbreak of incomprehensible hissing and rasping.
Is it true?
Said Gaunt in a deadly voice, advancing a step or two toward the terrified girl.
My daughter, pure blood descendant of Salazar Slytherin, hankering after a filthy, dirt-veined muggle?
Merope shook her head frantically, pressing herself into the wall, apparently unable to speak.
But I got him, father,
cackled Morfin.
I got him as he went by, and he didn't look so pretty with hives all over him, did he, Merope? You disgusting little squib, you filthy little blood chaser,
roared Gaunt, losing control, and his hands closed around his daughter's throat. Both Harry and Ogden yelled,
No!
At the same time. Ogden raised his wand and cried,
Villaggio!
Gaunt was thrown backward away from his daughter. He tripped over a chair and fell flat on his back. With a roar of rage, Morfin leapt out of his chair and ran at Ogden, brandishing his bloody knife and firing hexes indiscriminately from his wand. Ogden ran for his life. Dumbledore indicated that they ought to follow, and Harry obeyed, Merope's screams echoing in his ears. Ogden hurtled up the path and erupted onto the main lane, his arms over his head, where he collided with the glossy chestnut horse ridden by a very handsome, dark-haired young man. Both he and the pretty girl riding beside him on a grey horse roared with laughter at the sight of Ogden, who bounced off the horse's flank and set off again, his frock coat flying, covered from head to foot in dust, running pell-mell up the lane.
"I think that will do, Harry,"
said Dumbledore. He took Harry by the elbow and tugged. Next moment they were both soaring weightlessly through darkness, until they landed squarely on their feet, back in Dumbledore's now twilight office. "What happened to the girl in the cottage?" said Harry at once, as Dumbledore lit extra lamps with a flick of his wand. "Merope, or whatever her name was."
"Oh, she survived,"
said Dumbledore, reseating himself behind his desk and indicating that Harry should sit down too.
"Ogden apparated back to the Ministry and returned with reinforcements within 15 minutes. Morfin and his father attempted to fight, but both were overpowered, removed from the cottage, and subsequently convicted by the Wizengamot. Morfin, who already had a record of muggle attacks, was sentenced to 3 years in Azkaban. Marvolo, who had injured several ministry employees, in addition to Ogden, received 6 months.
Marvolo? Harry repeated, wonderingly.
That's right, said Dumbledore, smiling in approval. I'm glad to see you're keeping up.
That old man was
Voldemort's grandfather, yes,
said Dumbledore.
Marvolo, his son Morfin, and his daughter Merope were the last of the Gaunts, a very ancient wizarding family noted for a vein of instability and violence that flourished through the generations due to their habit of marrying their own cousins. Lack of sense coupled with a great liking for grandeur meant that the family gold was squandered several generations before Marvolo was born.
He, as you saw, was left in squalor and poverty with a very nasty temper, a fantastic amount of arrogance and pride, and a couple of family heirlooms that he treasured just as much as his son, and rather more than his daughter. So, Merope, said Harry, leaning forward in his chair and staring at Dumbledore, so Merope was... Sir, does that mean she was Voldemort's mother? It does, said Dumbledore. And it so happens that we also had a glimpse of Voldemort's father.